Welcome back to the Offspring Magazine podcast. This is Xiaoran, and I will be hosting today's podcast with B. Today, we will talk with Professor Ferdi Schutt. He's the director of Max Planck Institute für Konvolution in Mülheim an der Ruhr, Germany. Today's conversation is about energy system in the near future. This podcast will be released in two parts. I hope you will enjoy today's podcast. Hi, Professor Schutt. Thank you so much for joining us today's podcast, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Ferdi Schutt, 62 years old. I'm a chemist by training, still work as a chemist, not only by training chemist, but still work as a chemist. I'm director here at the Max Planck Institute für Kohlenforschung. I'm interested in many things, in science and catalysis, energy, also other things. I get easily interested in things.
So what kind of researchers are your group doing currently?
We work mostly on catalysis, catalyst synthesis, nanostructured catalysts, and particularly high on my list of interest, and actually that's what most people in the group do, is currently electrochemistry and mechanochemical reactions, ball milling reactions, which fascinate me because this is so little understood. And everything which is not really understood is fascinating. Everything which is predictable and well known is kind of boring, I would say. So it needs to be questions around.
Can you explain, like, specifically about electrochemistry? What are you doing about this aspect?
What interests me most is actually reactions at the anode of an electrochemical cell. Mm-hmm. So if we think about future energy systems in which hydrogen may play a major role, then the hydrogen is produced at the cathode of an electrolyzer. At the anode of an electrolyzer, oxygen is produced. And what do we do with the oxygen? We let it into the atmosphere, and then it's gone. So it is not creating any value, but it is the more difficult of the two reactions. Hydrogen evolution is way easier than oxygen evolution, so oxygen evolution makes it difficult, but we throw it away. Yeah. And it would be interesting to couple hydrogen evolution with something which actually generates value at the anode side of an electrolyzer. There is one example every, almost say, freshman chemist knows. When you produce chlorine, it's an electrochemical production. So you produce chlorine at the anode, and the hydrogen which you produce at the cathode is actually the byproduct. But in a future energy system, we are interested in the hydrogen, and we want to produce something value generating on the anode. And we look at different reactions which really can be used at high production volumes, because otherwise in the framework of the energy system, it doesn't help you if you produce 1,000 tons per year. You need massive volumes. And so one we are interested in is producing purine dicarboxylic acid. That's something you can make from biomass, and it could replace terephthalic acid for PET polymers. So that would be an interesting one. We also have one where sugars are eventually converted to adipic acid. Adipic acid goes into nylon production. So these polymer production processes are the ones which are really used massive production volume. So that's the kind of reactions which is interesting to us. And so we try to find ways to do that on the anode to make essentially the cathode reaction, which we are really interested in, cheaper.
Why do you think hydrogen will play an important role in the future energy system?
If you look at our current energy system, it's mostly based on fossils.
Yes.
Everyone knows we want to get away from fossil to replace the combustion processes in cars, power plants, which release CO2 and contribute to global warming. And the way to do it is renewables. I would say we currently have three big types of renewables. It's biomass, it is wind, and it is solar, photovoltaics essentially. And both wind and photovoltaics generate as the primary product electricity. electricity has the problem, unless we have really good and big batteries, that it needs to be consumed as it is produced. And so we have a problem with storage, both short time but also seasonal storage, at least in parts of the world. Moreover, both the wind and the sun are unevenly distributed over the world. Not as unevenly as hydrocarbons in the ground, but still unevenly distributed. And so we would need to bring electricity from the areas where they are produced, Australia, North Africa, the deserts in the US, the deserts in South America, or the coasts where we have high winds, and which are typically not densely populated, to the centers where we consume the electricity. So of course, we all know we can use cables, but cables over 10,000 kilometers is long. I mean, it's not undoable. High voltage direct current can be transported over very long distances, but still you need the agreement of everyone on the line. You may need to have the cables under the ocean, which is doable, but again, costly and difficult. And we still need then to buffer the temporarily uneven generation of electricity. And hydrogen, or let's put it more broadly, a material, a chemical, is a good method to transport energy, because you can use high energy content chemicals, transport them, and then convert them to low energy content chemicals. Like, simplest case, hydrogen, high energy content, we burn it, produce water, low energy content. And so, since we need both the transportation function and the storage function, I think hydrogen will be an important element in a future energy infrastructure. On top of that, a substantial contributor to CO2 emissions and thus global warming is also chemical production. Ammonia, for instance, but also the other chemicals are responsible for a substantial footprint in CO2. And we could essentially convert the whole chemical industry to a sustainable basis if we have enough hydrogen. Look at a flow chart of chemical production globally, painting with a very broad brush. The chemical industry produces, depends on the source where you look at, but let's say several 10,000 different compounds. Now you could look at each of the several 10,000 different compounds and try to find out, how can I make that production sustainable? Or we can look at our feedstocks, the intermediate steps, the final steps, and look at the feedstocks. And if you look at the feedstocks, we basically in the chemical industry have approximately a handful of really important molecule types. It's aromatics, it's olefins, which have the olefin value chain. It is nitrogen, hydrogen for ammonia production as a single one. And then we have methanol for C1 chemistry. That captures basically almost the whole feedstock basis of the chemical industry. If we can make this feedstock basis sustainable, we don't have to worry about the rest. We just have the entry point as a sustainable one. And if we have enough hydrogen, this is doable, because with enough hydrogen, we could hydrogenate CO2 even, capture it from the air or from point sources. We have methanol. Methanol we can make by the methanol to olefins process, ethylene and propylene. Can adjust the ratios even by running the process properly. Or we can produce the ethylene from bioethanol by dehydration, also sustainable entry point into the value chain. Hydrogen we make renewably anyway. Nitrogen we get from the atmosphere. Aromatics are the only one which is a bit more difficult, but lignocellulose consists of approximately 30% aromatics, and that's the biggest chemical produced in the world by our plants. And so if we have all the aromatic feeds from lignocellulose, if we have olefin feeds from methanol to olefins, if we have the C1 feeds from methanol, the ammonia feed from nitrogen and hydrogen, we are more or less set. And so even if the hydrogen would not be important at all, for the energy system, it would be extremely important to put the chemical industry on a sustainable basis. And so hydrogen will be a very crucial molecule in the future.
So I guess here, I mean, essentially we're talking about a hydrogen economy, right? And
yeah.
Just for the listeners that maybe aren't so aware of this, can you maybe define exactly what a hydrogen economy is? And then we can start talking more about it.
I actually wouldn't call it hydrogen economy.
Ah, okay.
I would call it a sustainable energy / production future. And hydrogen is an important element.
Mm-hmm.
The more important element will actually be electrons. So we will have lots of electrification. All our transport, or most of our transport, will be electric. Battery electric mm-hmm. vehicles. Heating will go to electric. So instead of our gas-fired heating, we will have heat pumps probably, or resistive heating,
mm-hmm.
or solar heating, direct solar heating, depending where we are on the globe. And then we have hydrogen for chemical production. So it will be a major element in a future energy production infrastructure, for instance, also for making steel. Currently, we make steel from reduction of iron ores by coke. There is processes where you can do it with hydrogen. And so we would make steel production maybe not fully sustainable, but much more sustainable. So hydrogen is an element in many different production processes and energy processes in the future. I wouldn't go so far call it hydrogen economy. We're also not calling our current economy the hydrocarbon economy. One could. But I mean, currently we are much, much more relying on hydrocarbons than we will on hydrogen. That's what I want to say. Currently we are relying to a much higher extent on hydrocarbons than we will in a future energy system on hydrogen.
Yeah.
Relative importance in the overall system of hydrogen will be smaller than hydrocarbons nowadays.
Yeah. But then it's all about, you know, what you want is you want to be generating this hydrogen sustainably. Like you said.
And I mean, so any hydrogen which we produce with a big CO2 footprint
doesn't make sense at all.
We may as well just burn the natural gas or whatever.
Exactly, I agree. So how much of the hydrogen currently is produced sustainably?
I don't know the number. I'm pretty sure less than 5%.
Yeah. Okay, so we still have a long way to go to be able to generate 100% of our hydrogen in a sustainable manner.
Yes, I mean, not... Of course, we have a long way to go. We need much, much more hydrogen in the future. If we want to convert, like I described before, the chemical industry to a hydrogen basis, this will explode.
Also, because it's not just about converting the current chemical industry. We're going to keep on growing. Like, the chemical industry will be growing exponentially, especially with...
Maybe, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe we shouldn't grow it exponential because... Our biggest, I wouldn't really call it sustainable, but our biggest hydrocarbon source, which we could tap into, is actually waste plastics. So if we would recycle more, we wouldn't need to grow exponentially. Mm. I mean, we are talking about several hundred million tons per year plastic waste, and that's hydrocarbons. Of course, there is some chlorine in there from PVC, there is oxygen in there from PET, there is nitrogen in there from polyamides, but the backbone is hydrocarbons. So if we could recycle these waste streams in a way to recover the hydrocarbons, we actually can replace many of the current feedstock by just recycled plastics. That's the biggest, volume-wise, by far the biggest product of the chemical industry, all the different types of plastics. Much more important volume-wise, weight-wise than all the other ones. So we don't need to necessarily grow exponentially. But still, the hydrogen needs to be produced in a sustainable manner. It may, however, not take so long to switch to a more sustainable production than one would think in building electrolyzers all over the world, because at least for a transition period, if we would be willing, and I think we should, to enter carbon capture and sequestration, or more precisely carbon dioxide capture and sequestration, we could generate the so-called blue hydrogen, which is hydrogen made from natural gas by orthothermal reforming or steam reforming, capture the CO2, put it underground in an aquifer or in a storage site, and then we essentially have hydrogen which is produced without CO2 footprint and without the need to have electrolyzers, because it will take decades to have the electrolyzer capacity deployed all over the world to produce green hydrogen at this amount. So for a transition period, I think blue hydrogen would be an acceptable solution. And blue hydrogen, or let's say the CCS, carbon dioxide capture and sequestration, which we would do in connection with blue hydrogen, would be important anyway, because we have sectors in our civilization which are called the hard to abate sectors. Cement production.
Yeah.
I mean, cement is made by firing lime, stone, and silica, and that's the essential components. Limestone is calcium carbonate. We need to convert it to calcium oxide, and there is chemically no way around releasing the CO2. So what are you going to do with the CO2? Maybe the simplest is capture it, put it away under the ground. And so we need these technologies, these so-called negative emission technologies, which actually do not emit CO2, but where we actually remove CO2, we need them anyway, because we have the hard to abate sectors, and to offset the emissions from the hard to abate sectors, we may need to remove CO2 from the atmosphere in any case.
You mentioned this blue hydrogen, green hydrogen. I think there are also gray hydrogen.
There is a whole color code of hydrogen. Blue and green and gray are the better known ones. There are other ones.
Maybe you could explain a bit, otherwise the audience might
get it. So gray, green, and blue are relatively well defined. Mm-hmm. Gray is the one which you make by orthothermal reforming or steam reforming from hydrocarbons, either methane, oil, or others. You can even get worse. You may call it black hydrogen. You can reform coal.
Mm.
Then you have even more CO2 emissions per hydrogen generated. So this is why we have different shades of gray. Let's put it like this. We have green hydrogen. That's the one we make by electrolysis. So water, electricity, hydrogen, oxygen production. We have blue hydrogen, which is essentially the same as gray hydrogen, but the CO2 produced is captured and put underground in storage sites. There is purple hydrogen. Now I have to think to get it correct. Purple is mostly used for hydrogen where you split methane into carbon and hydrogen, which you can also do. You don't have to go from methane by reforming to syngas and then shift reaction, but you can split it directly to carbon and hydrogen and then put the carbon away. In old coal mines, for instance, put the carbon back where we took it from, for instance. That would also be hydrogen without CO2 emissions. And then there are different color codes for reddish hydrogen, which is hydrogen produced by electrolysis, but not with solar energy, but with nuclear energy. So if we're, this is sometimes also called yellow hydrogen. So as I said, the gray, blue, green is pretty clearly defined. For the other ones, there are different explanations in different parts of the world.
You mentioned we can produce hydrogen by electricity, but I think there are some groups which are working on photocatalysis to use the solar power directly.
Yes.
That split water.
Yes.
What do you think about these techniques?
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Scientifically highly interesting. I don't think it will be the basis of big technology. And the reason is that, at the end, it always comes down to a cost question.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, everything in the energy system is governed by cost. And often it's very low margin processes, so cost is very important. Now, the current efficiencies of photocatalytic splitting are relatively low.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a solar cell plus an electrolyzer is extremely efficient. I mean, we always say evolution, the green plants, they have optimized everything so well, and they are really good in energy harvesting. They aren't. If you look how much a field produces on a square meter basis, a field of normal plants harvests on the order of 1% of the solar energy. So 1% of the solar energy is used and used to create plants, biomass, energy content biomass. If we take a run-of-the-mill solar cell, not a high-efficient research cell, a run-of-the-mill solar cell you buy in the store and put on your roof, 20% efficiency, 20% of the sunlight converted to electricity. An electrolyzer added to it, and we take a bad electrolyzer, which has maybe 60% efficiency, then we have 12% overall efficiency over the cycle. Sunlight to an energy content chemical. So we have beat nature by a factor of 10. We are 10 times better than nature in photosynthesis. It's not bad. But yeah. That's actually pretty good. And this will be difficult to beat with a photocatalytic water splitter. Then if you have your photocatalytic water splitter, that would be a system, you have a puddle of water or big plastic bags of water and a catalyst in there floating in the water, sunlight shines on it, and the catalyst would split the water to hydrogen and oxygen. We have a number of problems which I think at least suggest that it will be difficult to compete with electrolyzer and a photovoltaic cell. First of all, you have to separate the hydrogen and the oxygen. Otherwise, you have knallgas, the explosive mixture which you don't want to have. So that's the first challenge. Can probably be done. But the other challenge you then have is that you have a distributed field. I mean, this is massive installation, square kilometers of plastic bags with water and the photocatalyst. And you generate a gas, and what you then need is piping, compressors, dryers to direct the gas to a central storage location from each of these bags. Mm-hmm. And this is what is called in technology the balance of plant. It's not the system which does the work itself, but all the periphery which is used to handle it. This is compared to just cables in an electrolyzer photovoltaic cell system. And frankly, I don't see that the photocatalytic splitting system with all the piping, gas handling system required, distributed over square kilometers, will at the end be cheaper than just a solar cell and a central electrolyzer. I may be wrong, I may eat my words, but if I had to bet money, I would place all my money on electrolyzer plus.
Are you sure all of your money?
All of the money I want to invest in that.
Okay. So does your group research, what kind of research do you do at the Institute currently dealing with hydrogen?
With hydrogen, we actually, and as I said, we look at the anode reaction in my particular group.
That's
so that's essentially electrolyzer work, hydrogen electrolyzer work. We also look at fuel cells, which is the inverse reactions of the electrolyzer. So taking hydrogen and burning it, not with a flame, but converting it in an electrochemical device, generating electricity out of the hydrogen again. So we try to improve fuel cell catalysts. There is Michael Felderhoff's group working on hydrogen storage and heat storage, which can actually be combined in an intelligent way, because we also would need to store heat maybe in the future, which is currently already being done. You store heat in the summer and use it for heating in the winter. You can actually do seasonal storage by just big water tanks. Mm-hmm. And Michael tries to do it a bit more intelligently. Claudia's group, and we have also done that before in my own group, is working on ammonia splitting, which could be a very interesting reaction in a future energy system, because in a future system, let's say we produce the hydrogen in the Australian desert and we want to bring it to Central Europe. How are you going to do it? You won't have a compressed hydrogen ship. The density is ridiculously low, even if you compress it to very high pressures of, let's say, 700 bar, which is difficult in a volume like you have on a ship.
So you, there is different ways now of transporting it. The maybe most obvious one is liquefied hydrogen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So go to minus 254 centigrades or whatever it is, liquefy it, and have it in a cryo tanker, like you do with liquefied natural gas. Generally doable. Has been an experimental transport actually from Australia to Japan, has been done on a relatively small scale.
Mm-hmm.
That ship lost a lot of hydrogen because it boils off. Of course, you can use part of that hydrogen to power the ship. So the gas hydrogen which boils off, you would feed in the turbine of the ship and power the ship with it. But still, we need improvements there. And there are people who don't believe in transporting liquid hydrogen. I'm not so sure. There I wouldn't place all my money on one solution. Another form would be ammonia. Ammonia is relatively economically, also energy economically synthesized. It's one of the most efficient processes because it has been optimized over more than 100 years. Produce ammonia from nitrogen and hydrogen, ship the ammonia, then at the target site, either use the ammonia as a fertilizer or you decompose the ammonia again to nitrogen and hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you use the hydrogen. So ammonia decomposition, making that more efficient, making ammonia decomposition cheap, could actually be a very important element in a future energy infrastructure if we ship the hydrogen in form of ammonia. We may use methanol as the form to ship hydrogen. As I said, you could basically, if you convert the chemical industry to a sustainable basis, it all goes back to hydrogen, but the intermediate form for most value chains is then methanol. And so that's also a good way of transporting hydrogen. As I said, Claudia is working on ammonia decomposition, so that could be an important element in a future energy infrastructure. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated by the idea of producing your electricity in different parts of the world and then transporting and being able to get this electricity in Europe, say, especially when we're dealing with solar or wind, like Europe's not the best for this, and there's definitely other places.
That's part one. Thank you very much for listening. If you would like to learn more about Professor Ferdi Schütt and his research, you could look at his website. See you next week for part two.